Welcome to a very special edition of Political Rewind. In the studio today, the senior United States Senator from the state of Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, is joining us for the show. And with me to talk to him, as usual on a Monday, the political writer of the AJC, Jim Galloway. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com, which Greg Bluestein, a political reporter for the AJC, is a frequent contributor to. Thank you both for being here for this conversation.
No, wouldn't have missed this one. This is kind of our prequel to tonight's town hall.
Senator Isaacson, we're thrilled to have you here. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Bill. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Let's start with the news over the weekend, if we can. Like the rest of the country, you saw the violence unfold in Virginia, Charlottesville. A lot of it inspired by the white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazis. What did you think as you watched all this unfold? And we saw the unfortunate incident in which a young woman was killed by a car driven into the crowd.
Well, hate born in the hearts of any man or woman on the basis of race is intolerable, and the Klan, the neo-Nazis, and the white supremacists represent everything that's wrong with life and humanity. It was a sickening weekend, and it should be denounced to its highest level by everybody in elected office, and it's repugnant to me.
We're going to play in just a minute President Trump's statement, which he made within the last, about hour and 10 minutes from the White House, in which he did in fact condemn the white supremacists. But before we play his remarks, were you surprised, disappointed by the fact that he did not immediately do two things, condemn the violence and at the same time speak out about the death of the young woman involved?
I think as an elected official, particularly as the governor of a state where a tragedy might take place or president of a country where something like that might take place, if something that rises to that level of horror takes place, it should be expeditiously and quickly addressed by the leader of that country or that state.
I was actually kind of surprised that when Trump failed to do so, we saw a good number of Republicans kind of step up and show him how it was done. Marco Rubio had something out. Ted Cruz immediately called for an investigation. Of course, Jeff Flake, and I'm missing one, Cory Gardner.
Gardner, who made probably the best statement of all.
Mm-hmm. Right. Remind me what he said.
Well, I can't quote it verbatim, but it was just a clear, concise, direct statement and directed directly to the president, pointing to his need to be aware of how difficult, how horrible, and how it should be totally written off.
So Cory Gardner is in, as you point out, he's a senator from Colorado, which we consider to be a purple state, a swing state. Is it harder, Senator, if you are, as you are, in an all-red state like Georgia, is it harder to be able to talk publicly when you think the president has not done the right thing?
No, it's not harder. I mean, right's right and wrong is wrong. And when something carries to that level, not only is it not hard, but it's incumbent upon me as an elected official with some standing in the state to speak out against it.
Did he take too long, two days? Was the 2 days too long to specifically rebuke these white supremacist groups?
Any pause could be measured as too long because it's a how do you gauge the measurement? It should be swift. It should be concise. It should be to the point. And it should be leave no room for equivocation or speculation on anybody's mind as to where the president stands.
So with all that said, why don't we listen to a little bit? As I mentioned, the president spoke within the past hour plus from the White House. He was under a lot of criticism, Jim. I mean, there were a lot, you pointed out, all the Republican senators who came forward and others saying you've got to respond
and then,
to this.
And then if we had just a little more context, we had Ken Frazier, the CEO of Merck, resigned from his manufacturing commission, pointing to the lack of any condemnation. And of course, Trump immediately attacked Fraser,
yeah,
who is one of the few African American CEOs of a Fortune 500 company.
Let's listen to just a bit of the president's statement, which was clearly a scripted statement, which is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But let's listen to part of what he had to say.
We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal. We are equal in the eyes of our Creator. We are equal under the law, and we are equal under our Constitution. Those who spread violence in the name of bigotry strike at the very core of America.
Jim, you said you were waiting through that statement to hear him call out those specific organizations.
And finally he did. Senator, we're in a situation where politics is more polarized than either you or me have ever experienced, I think. And you've got a town hall coming up at Kennesaw State University at 6:30 tonight. Your first of the year. You've had some medical issues that have prevented you from having one earlier. This is also the first day of classes for KSU, so you're likely to have a whole lot of students in the audience. So what do you tell these kids about how to approach politics? Because they're going to be the ones to inherit the situation that you and I have left them.
Well, they're going to be the next senators, the next writers for the AJC, the next TV and radio, public television people. They're going to be the next presidents of the United States or the next United States senators. They may not think so now, but out of them, one of them will be each of those things around the country. And because of that, issues like this are so important, because this is about what we are and who we are as Americans. There are certain things that rise to the level of being what you're really all about, and sort of civil rights, the way you treat your fellow man, the heritage of our country is on the line for something like this. So I would tell any student who asked tonight if they what they should be interested in, they should be interested in contemporary events, particularly those that measure what kind of a people we are, and doing whatever they can do in their career, in their life, and their family to perpetuate all that is good and great about the United States of America.
Senator, would you encourage them to go into politics?
I've never discouraged any. Well, I take that back. I've given good advice to some people who didn't take it. but generally, if somebody wants to get in, I encourage them, because we have politics in America is a participatory sport. You get to play, you got to participate and volunteer. And I think the more people we have in the game, the better off we are in results.
And was what Jim said true? I mean, is this the most, because we are caught up in some rhetoric, but is this the most polarizing time you've ever seen? Or is this a throwback to 15 years ago when, you know, gridlock still
or existed.
Or the 60s or whatever.
My first victory was in 1976. Jimmy Carter was elected president. The biggest issue in the Georgia General Assembly was a Vinson Wall resolution to admonish the president for entering into the Panama Canal Treaty. I've been there since Roe versus Wade, the Panama Canal, the Cornhusker kickback. You go back on time and time again. Each one of those times, that seemed like the worst one ever. This one certainly seems like it now, but there will be others to come. And at the time they took place years ago, there were others that would be equal to today.
Senator, I want to go back, if I could, for a minute, to talk still about the president and the violence this weekend. You have probably heard that there were a couple of posts on white supremacist websites and blogs. And comments made about the fact that President Trump basically is on our side. He understands us. And when the president neglected to call out the names of those organizations, as he did today, do you think what happens there is the David Dukes of the world who said, this is our president, we're rallying because of him? I guess I'm asking you to speculate. Do they see this as a winking kind of assertion statement by the president, believing that he's still on their side, but that he doesn't have much choice? In other words, did he give them comfort by not responding quickly? And do they take his remarks today with less seriousness than they might have had he done it immediately?
People of no standing and no credibility will seek any way they can to get it, including stealing it from somebody who's got it. That's why if you're an elected official and someone embraces you as their hero, yet they stand for something that you're against, if you don't speak out, then you're by acquiescence endorsing what they do.
So in a way, perhaps they do see this as a sort of a wink and a nod that, don't worry, I'm not as against you as I have to speak out today.
I would not say they see it as that. I'd say they're trying to use it as that.
Okay.
There's a difference in those two things.
If we could just shift topics a little bit, Senator Isaacson, we've got a really big issue yet to settle, health care, that y'all tried and tried and tried and didn't get through in July. When you come back after Labor Day, it probably is still going to be there waiting for you.
It will.
And, I mean, especially you've got an October deadline on some indigent payments, federal indigent payments to hospitals to worry about it. So there was a Kaiser poll out today that says, I think, 68% of Americans are glad that the Senate didn't repeal the Affordable Care Act. Where do you guys go? What happens now?
Well, nothing has changed about the realities of what's about to happen, and that is there are things we have got to do, whether it's repealed or not, to fix what is a broken plan and a broken law from the original Affordable Care Act. Just take Atlanta, Georgia, and our state. The false premise that we would no longer have to make disproportional payments to charity hospitals like Grady because everybody was going to have health insurance, well, that's gone out the window.
Because we didn't expand Medicaid.
But that's gone out the window anyway, because a lot of people didn't buy insurance to go in and use Grady Hospital, or if they bought insurance, they still use Grady Hospital. The point of my matter is they used monies they thought they were going to create by providing an access towards a bronze policy, say, as monies that would be newfound monies to help underwrite the cost to those who bought it for subsidies in terms of health care. There were a lot of false assumptions and premises that were taken by people on both sides of the health care issue that just didn't work out. So we've got to make sure those are fixed, and we work on those. I was on the committee in 2009, the Health Education Labor and Commission Committee with Ted Kennedy and Chris Dodd that debated for 89 committee meetings the Affordable Care Act and passed it on New Year's Eve, the Senate did, or Christmas Eve of 2009. I'm on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee now. We are preparing and have been asked to prepare to have hearings and meetings this fall on what we're going to do about the Affordable Care Act and taking some of the things that we got this close. I'm holding my fingers very closely together. This close to finding some of those solutions and making them happen, try and make them happen, because the problem is not going away and the challenge is not going away, and we can't go away. We've got to find a way to solve as many of those problems as we can.
Georgia leaders, seeing the failure of a Senate repeal bill, are taking a deeper look now at coming back next year and applying for some sort of Medicaid waiver that could lead to a limited expansion of the Medicaid program and other additional federal money. Is that the right tack, or should they wait?
Well, they're preparing for whatever they need to be prepared for, not knowing which way we're going to go.
Yeah.
And so I think they're doing the responsible thing and look at avenues down the way to take care of what they have to do with their responsibility. Hopefully we're going to make that a moot point later on, but right now they're doing the right thing to prepare for it.
Are y'all going to need to work with Democrats to get that 50% plus one vote?
Absolutely.
And what?
Wait a minute. You said to get the 50% plus one.
Or 60%.
It may not be possible. Well, let me, but that's an important question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Given what happened in Atlanta this weekend and what's happening in both parties from a standpoint of the my way or the highway in terms of working together, it would be very difficult for a Democrat to vote with 49 Republicans to get us to 51 in the Senate. That was your question.
Well, that's an excellent point. Yeah,
it would be very, and it would be and if the shoe were on the other foot, it'd be difficult with us. I mean, the price you pay as a partisan politician in a caucus in the United States Senate today, more so than the House, but it's certainly true in the House as well. If you cross that line, you've got to cross it in full view of a lot of people who don't want you to do it for a lot of reasons that make sense, and for a lot of reasons that don't. So the honest answer today is it'd be very difficult to do. But I got a sneaking suspicion that it will happen. I think eventually there's going to be a consensus number. Maybe it's 54, maybe it's 55, maybe it's 58. That gets you to the point that you can do something.
So, Senator, you have a very busy agenda when you get back right after Labor Day. The tax, you may or may not address tax reform. It appears you're certainly going to address legislation to cut taxes. You're going to have a debt ceiling to deal with. You know the long list of items that are awaiting you. One of our tweeters just asked, in terms of health care, would you go along with an effort to go back to health care when you return from this break before you move on to tax reform and some of these other issues? That's from Ross Hardy, who tweets at Georgia Wonk.
I'm for moving forward in the most expeditious way possible to move the agenda forward. Let me add a couple of things that you didn't put in there.
Okay.
CHIP is up in September.
Yeah,
that's CHIP.
Yeah. Children's Health and CHIP, a very important program.
Which may be the platform to deal with health care.
Mm-hmm.
It's a germane debate. So there are a couple of things coming up in September and October germane to the subject of health care that may give you an opportunity a lot of people aren't thinking about today to put some solutions in place.
Is that a 60 vote margin or a 50 vote?
Probably 60.
Okay.
You've also got coming up that you said the debt ceiling, which you don't default on your debt,
right?
And we're at $19 trillion, almost $20 trillion, too much debt. We've got to do something about it. But default is not what you do about it. What you do about it is begin to change your habits over time, which we finally are getting. David Perdue is doing a good job by the way of speaking out on that subject. I've done a pretty good job over the years in my biennial budget process. We're trying to make that happen. That's a wonky type of a subject, but bankruptcy is a terrible thing for a country to go through, and we're mm-hmm. pushing ourselves towards that. You've got the implications of the North Korea conundrum, which are going to be right in our lap come September, I'm confident, because I think Kim Jong-un is having the best time of his life right now, playing us like a harp on a string. But we've got to do something about that, and we've got to be strong on that subject.
Do you, I want to stop you there if you don't mind, because you just raised an interesting issue point. Where is the, what do you imagine? I mean, you've now got a president who has made extremely bellicose statements, as you well know, about North Korea. What is the Senate's role going to be in dealing with where he's taken the country in terms of his remarks? And what's the job going to be in the Senate to deal with this?
Well, make sure you've paid your Verizon bill, because here comes one to get you some mail. what America needs right now is what I've always said was represented in my two favorite presidents of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Ronald Wilson Reagan. John Kennedy, at a time of great challenge with Cuba, took them to the point of provocation to force them to play their hand, and he won. The Russians receded from Cuba. Ronald Reagan did the same thing when he stood before the Berlin Wall and said, "Tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev," and they did. Both of them lowered taxes at a time the economy was sluggish and brought them back. Both of them had the capability to stand in front of a group of American people who disagreed with them and make a speech and change their mind. It's time for us to look for that type of leadership with the challenges we have ahead of us, just like the ones that may come from the decisions.
So let me make sure I understand that. And then, Greg, I want to get you in here again. Are you saying that you believe the president's rhetoric, in fact, showed a strength that's necessary in confronting North Korea?
Now,
right
now? I was just saying, that may be your interpretation, but what
it,
I was
It was,
saying,
and that's why I'd like for you to clarify.
What I'm just
it.
Saying is we need a president like the case of those two cases of international threat to us, who's willing to provoke the enemy and call their hand. We did it with Khrushchev in Cuba with a blockade of Cuba. We did it by Reagan standing on the wall in Berlin and saying, "Tear down this wall."
Yeah.
Now's the time for an overt, defining moment to put the onus on the other side to play their hand. And you can do it without firing a shot. Kennedy, the blockade was not a shot. Pardon me. It was not a shot fired. When Reagan stood on the wall, it was not a shot fired. But the statements were so strong, or the act was so decisive, it forced the other side to play the hand, and both of them blinked and looked the other way.
And Kennedy didn't fire a shot, despite counsel from some military generals who were heroes of World War II, who were encouraging him to do preemptive strikes and use the nuclear arsenal. Are you confident that Donald Trump is that president who can show that leadership?
We've been fortunate as a country over 230-odd years and more to always at the right time for the right reasons, for the best of our country and the best of its leaders to come forward. And if a case of national security or your very life it's at stake. I'm always hoping we'll elicit the best out of whomever's the president, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, from the West Coast or the East Coast, popular or unpopular.
Senator, we have to take a quick break. If we can, we'd like to have a few more minutes with you on the other side of the break. Okay with you?
I'm having a ball.
All right.
It's warm up.
We enjoy ourselves here 3 days a week. You can come back anytime you want.
I'll be back.
You're listening to Political Rewind. Georgia Senior Senator Johnny Isaacson is in the studio live with us. Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway are here. Let's get a break out of the way and come back with Senator Isaacson.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Senator Johnny Isaacson is in the studio with us. You know, Jim, I think it's appropriate to just take a moment to say, you know, Bluestein is the youngster in this group. You and I have covered...
Who I think is in his mid-30s.
35.
You and I have covered Johnny Isaacson. I have since 19, around 83 or 4... And you're not far behind.
Oh, I think I may have you beat by a couple years.
You do?
I was over at the state capitol the Paul Coverdell, Johnny Isaacson
years. That's right.
During the Lee Redonis.
Yep, when he was ran the Georgia party.
And you were and Johnny was House Minority Leader.
We love to refer to those as the phone booth years.
You know,
that's when you called yourselves progressive Republicans.
Well, that's exactly what I was about to say. Senator, there was a time when people like you and as Jim mentioned, Paul Coverdale were proud Republicans. You certainly worked on behalf of the interests of the people of the state, but also advancing the agenda of the Georgia Republican Party. But it was a far different time. You worked collaboratively with Democrats in those days. You were able to reach across party lines, and that's completely out the window now.
Well, it is. I mean, part of the good thing about Paul and myself, we recognized early on that necessity is the mother of invention. And when Tom Murphy's got 180, has got 88 votes and you've got 12, then necessity is the mother of invention. And you find a way to find common
Tom
ground.
Tom Murphy, of course, was the Democratic Speaker of the House for many years.
We were learned under the fire adversity, and that teaches you a lot.
So let's talk about that, if we can. You were profiled by the New York Times within the last couple months. Because of your work, particularly as chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee. But the headline of the story about you said, a bipartisan Congress that works, Veterans Committee shows how it does. It's done. And among other things, the Times says, Mr. Isaacson, a former real estate executive, is among an increasingly rare breed of deal makers in the upper chambers. Those watching the Veterans Affairs Committee say he's gone a long way to set the tone for its work. And he talks about your having made a partnership with John Tester of Montana, who's the committee's ranking Democratic member. And Tester says, with Johnny at the helm, we've been able to get a lot of stuff done. Do Johnny and I agree on everything? No, we don't, but we believe we can communicate and move forward. So how, in an increasingly partisan bitterly divided Congress, do you manage to make that happen? I suppose one reason is there's an awful lot of support for the veterans in this country. But what's right. The secret?
Well, there is, and that's true. The veterans are number one with almost everybody. There probably are a few that might not be the case, but almost everybody. But the truth of the matter is, if you can work with the other, if you demonstrate in your work that you're willing to work with the other side, and when that moment comes where you make a call that sends them to signal, hey, I'm ready to play, and then you stick to your guns, it's a remarkable what you can do. We just got through putting together six major bills on the redoing the entire Veterans Administration, from breaking down the backlog on appeals for veterans disability to breaking the union's hold on employment by tearing down the Merit System Protection Board so people can be fired if they don't do the job, by giving whistleblowers the protection so they can report in a timely fashion and feel they won't lose their jobs when things aren't being done right, and I could go on and on. Those were all done, quite frankly, because on the first one, the accountability bill, and the one about the Merit System Protection Board, the Democrats found out they could trust me. I delivered on a promise to them and asked them to deliver to me in return. And we passed out a 19-0 accountability vote. And everything else we've done has been all downhill because we trust each other.
Okay, let me ask you this. So when is bipartisanship the necessary strategy, and when is it not? Because, quite frankly, people will be look at your statements on health care. You've said many things. You said, like, for instance, that we need some version of encouragement for people to purchase health care so we can maintain pre-existing conditions. Yet you were one of the 48 senators, Republican senators, all Republican, who voted for that skinny repeal, which did not pass, but it was intended to get to conference. So explain to people why you went in that direction.
Because of what you said, but it was the way to get to conference. I mean, the way you begin to get to a decision and a final piece of work is get out of 535 people's hands and get into about 35 or 40 people's hands in a conference committee. That's number one. Number two, I want to go back to the first one. I want to thank you for the accurate, which you always do, but the extremely accurate and pointed coverage of what I've said in terms of health care, because I did make the statement about the individual mandate's got to go, but we got to find somebody to replace it. And you kind of did a tongue-in-cheek comment about that, saying, well, I wonder what that is. Let me give you an example. For years, we tried to find out a way to get people to buy car insurance. We finally created a situation called No Fault, so you can't get your license plate unless you buy car insurance to protect the people that you hit. All of a sudden, car insurance was, everybody had it, and we solved the problem. That's what we got to find a reason that causes people to say, you know, I need to go ahead and buy my own insurance. When everybody's buying insurance or buying some coverage, you amortize the risk over a larger pool of people. You lower the cost of pre-existing condition. You lower the cost of many other high-cost medical procedures, and everybody's playing the game. That's what I was referring to. And before we get through with this thing, there may be another form of no-fault insurance, but dealing with health care rather than automobiles.
You earlier called it my way or the highway politics, the sort of push towards ideological purity that both parties are facing. We saw it in Atlanta this weekend with the Netroots conference and Stacey Evans being shouted down because protesters didn't agree with what she was going to say. Is there any end in sight? Is there any solution to this? Or is this just the way politics is going to continue to be?
It'll die of self-inflicted wounds. Because you look over time, everything's been successful in the history of mankind, whether it's early days from Jesus Christ to current days we have today. When we've ultimately solved the great problems of the time, it wasn't done in a partisan or a one-way or the highway situation. It was done when people came together because there was a catalyst. The catalyst is out there. We just hadn't found it yet.
Senator, I want to...
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
You have enough water there? You all right?
Sir.
Okay. I want to ask you what I suspect is kind of a tough question, but I know you'll deal with it. In that New York Times article I quoted, one of the things they said about you is that you're courtly, and you are. You have always been known as one of the you have always been known as one of the most likable, easy to get along with elected officials in Georgia. I think it's one of the reasons that you win so much Democratic support as well as Republican support, because people believe that you're a sincere, honest guy, and that you're always going to work in the best interests of the people. So I want to ask you the hard question. How does that square with the conduct of the President of the United States? At what point do Republicans like yourself have an obligation to say that much of the way the president comports himself is simply unacceptable to people like you who have always tried to deal with politics with dignity and respect for everyone?
Well, I think what the president did yesterday, as he reflects back on what he did and how it happened, is beginning to see the merit to finding common ground. Yesterday, he signed the final three of the veterans' bills that we passed in committee and took great credit for the great accomplishments of his administration in passing those three bills.
Thank goodness he was there for you, Senator.
and I think that indicates he's seeing the wisdom of working together for a result rather than the wisdom of making
But that doesn't change his ad hominem angry attacks on some of your own colleagues, your leader, Mitch McConnell, the way he just goes after people who he feels he have wronged him in some way. Is this behavior okay?
You know, everybody's answer to a question like that is going to depend on the politics of the situation. I happen to have a story I can tell you about that.
Okay.
They ran ads against Dean Heller in Nevada
right
prior to the vote on the health care bill on the floor.
The Trump allies did, yeah, right.
Trump super PAC.
Mm-hmm. Some of those people were present at our weekly lunch, Republican lunch, and I raised my hand and asked to be recognized and said, I look forward to working with you, but I don't think anybody in the executive branch ought to be running ads against a member of the Republican Congress in the Senate against their reelection when they're trying to get them to help and support a bill to pass, and they took the ads down. You got to sometimes speak what you believe and be willing to let the chips fall where they may. Every time I've ever done it, I mean, there have been a few times I might have hit on the head by a few chips. But more often than not, people think discretion is the better part of valor and move forward.
But you prefer to do that in private settings, do you not?
I do.
You mentioned this earlier. Does Trump have any Kennedy or Reagan in him? I mean, do you see that? Do you see potential that he could become one of these next legendary presidents that you admire so?
All presidents are in part a product of the environment in which they serve. We've gone through 7 months of Reagan's first 48 months with challenges to beat the band from North Korea to Iran to everything else in between. And every president is driven, their legacy is driven by what confronted them after they got elected and was unknown at the time of the election. That probably will be true with Ronald, with him as well. It was with Reagan. It was with Kennedy.
We have time for just one or two more questions. My first question and my last question, really, and then Greg and Jim. I mentioned Senator McConnell, your leader. The president was very hard on him, blamed him for the failure of health care, blames him if you don't get all the other pieces of the Trump agenda accomplished. And your fellow Republicans have come to his aid, the majority leader's aid, and said, these are unfair attacks. Are they misguided attacks?
If you want to accomplish something, they're misguided. I mean, I was one of those that came out and spoke out 2 days ago. I mean, if you want to get something done, the wrong way to do it is to destroy the vehicle to which you get it done. You don't write a bill from a bill to a law without having a car to get you there. And the car to get him there is going to be the majority leader of the United States Senate.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You said that you like to have your confrontations in private. Obviously, John McCain has chosen a different route. Has he done the Republican caucus a favor with the way he stepped out in the last, say, 4, 5, 6 weeks?
You know, I have the most highest admiration for John McCain. He and I do not agree on a lot of things and have not agreed on some things. But there's universal agreement that he's an American hero. What he went through in North Vietnam and what he's gone through to serve the country since coming back from that and rehabilitating himself. He's earned the right to be John McCain and the variety of John McCain he wants to be. I would never find fault with that. And I think the people that are very short-sighted. America has very few heroes right now. One of them's in Arizona going through very difficult treatments for neuroblastoma, which may be the biggest enemy he's ever faced, and he's doing it with courage and grace. Last thing he needs is a bunch of Republicans criticizing him for being the man he is.
We have time for one last quick question, Greg. It's your turn.
Yeah, the Charlottesville protests have triggered a wave of debate across the nation about removing some of these Confederate statues, and Georgia has, at the Capitol and elsewhere, has plenty of them. Should Georgia, I know it's more of a state issue, but still, should Georgia consider removing some of these statues?
Let me quote a great Georgian of a few years ago when confronted with the question, Since George Washington had slaves, shouldn't we take his name off the Washington Monument? And Vizell Miller replied, you go first. I mean, there's just some things that you don't do, and that's what would be one of them in terms of that monument. So you use good judgment in terms of what you're doing, and I think that answer spoke for itself.
One of the things that makes this makes the complexity of some of this so clear, it may be one thing to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee. It is fascinating that Black Lives Matter ralliers over the weekend decided to choose the spot where they would come together to be in front of the statue of Thomas Jefferson, a slaveholder, of course, and a man who treated the children of slaves with what some people would consider great cruelty, selling them off to at a profit. I'm not defending whether Robert Lee should be there, but this is a much more complex matter than we sometimes think about it.
And all of our legacies as journalists or as elected officials are going to be the body of our work, not the one article we wrote or the one vote we cast.
Well, we are out of time with you, Senator, because you've given us more time than we asked of you in the first place. But thank you so much for being with us today. It'll be interesting to see how the town meeting goes tonight. Are you prepared for some? Going to have some. It could be a rough crowd up there for you,
600
Senator.
Of my closest friends.
Right. Senator Johnny Isaacson, thank you so much for being with us today. We hope to see you again soon.
Yes.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about state politics.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with poet Molly McCulley Brown about poetry, faith, and disability. Her new collection of poems was inspired by the notorious Virginia State Colony, known for its practice of eugenics, where persons of varying disabilities were committed. Brown grew up in the shadow of the colony and has cerebral palsy. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We really enjoyed having Johnny Isaacson here. He does have that big town meeting. I don't know about you two. I imagine you have. I've gotten a number of news releases from people who want to mobilize to criticize him tonight, to demonstrate against him tonight. It's likely to be a very raucous session.
Yeah, but you got to remember that that Kennesaw State University is Johnny Isaacson's home ground.
Well, okay.
That is,
and maybe
that's
why they chose it.
But the indivisible crowd will be out in force. There'll be, I imagine there'll be just as many people inside that building as outside.
As outside. Yeah. We did get a couple tweets from people who think that that the senator, when asked about Trump and his character, dodged the question. He did say that he is willing to take him on privately, doesn't like to do it publicly. There are people who think he really should do it publicly, and I get that. With the time, though, we have remaining, a huge story, I think, Greg Bluestein, you were there. One of the biggest stories in politics of the weekend, next to Charlottesville, was what happened at the Netroots Nation conference, convention, whatever they called it, in downtown Atlanta this weekend. These are the most liberal activists in they're not all Democrats. Progressive activists who may want to have an influence on Democratic Party politics. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah, these were, they described themselves as kind of the left of the left. There was about 3,000 of them, many from all over the country. There's a sizable group from Georgia. And most of them are vote Democratic, but are trying to push their party to the left. Stacey Abrams, when she spoke on Thursday, got kind of a hero's welcome. She talked about how she led what she called, and this is a story I'd never heard before, so I took particular note of it, was that she led this silent caucus called the Strike Team that helped change Republican policy and tried to fight Republican leadership back in 2008, 2009, before she became the minority leader. And when Stacey Evans spoke on Saturday, her team was fully prepared that she would have a rough go of it. This was more of a Stacey Abrams crowd.
Let's remind everybody, they are running against each other for the Democratic nomination for governor. Stacey Abrams is an African-American, and Stacey Evans is white.
And Stacey Evans was going to go up there and lay out her vision for why her platform of reaching out to white moderate voters who have fled the party was still a progressive vision. As soon as she took the podium, sign-wielding protesters formed a line in front of her, and chants broke out throughout this massive hotel ballroom of support black women, trust black women, support black women, trust black women, and others just were yelling, sit down. From my seat, sort of near the middle, I could barely hear her. She was struggling to get her speech. At times, she tried to sort of feud with the protesters and tried to, other times she implored them just to let her speak, let her speak.
Why don't we listen? We have just a little audio. You can't hear all of it clearly, but you can get a sense of what was going on, and then we'll talk about it. So we heard Stacey Evans trying to have a conversation, or trying to get her remarks made, and then we heard the crowd chanting "Trust Black Women," right?
Yeah, what you see happening right now is you see Stacey Abrams trying to redefine how you win a Georgia Democratic primary using an alliance of white progressive voters, and specifically African-American women, who are the most reliable demographic within the Democratic Party. The group supporting Abrams, national groups, I mean, they've picked up a Beyonce phrase, get information, get information. And it's that kind of discipline that you saw over the weekend. And that's got that has some tremendous implications for those who prefer a more traditional model of a biracial coalition that also reaches out to white voters.
So that's right. I mean, I really think you've got that correct. And Greg, what troubles me there, so I have two responses to this over the weekend, and I want to ask you to start, and Jim, I'd really love to hear your thoughts too. One of them is just this, that we've said on the show for a while now that a campaign that features a African-American candidate and a white candidate where we know race is going to be an issue is going to be very, very painful for the party to deal with. And we saw that play out so mm-hmm. clearly this weekend. But on a larger scale, I had another response to it. We already have heard, we know Republicans for a while have gone through struggles to figure out where African Americans fit with them. We know that some of the Trump supporters expressed views that could be considered racist to some extent. And now we see there doesn't seem to be a place where there's any kind of coming together. And now we see it among progressives and Democrats. The arguments were, Greg, based on your reporting, when you talked to people about why they were processing, it was, she's not black. Stacey Evans isn't black. It's troubling that this is where we've come.
Yeah, I mean, to paraphrase it, that is what one of the activists who demonstrated against Stacey Evans said, that she doesn't represent my community. Others said it was something to do with her education votes, but when pushed to articulate on what those education votes were, I got nowhere. I mean, I knew what they were, but I couldn't get anywhere with the activists who were demonstrating against them. So it was. It shows that these Bernie Sanders fissures haven't gone anywhere. It shows that the parties are as polarized as ever. And as you mentioned earlier, it shows that this race, which we all knew would have some sort of racial undertones, it's coming out early. I mean, this is only going to get more tense.
And it's made more sharp, I suppose, by the fact they're both focusing on educational issues. Yeah. I mean, Abrams accuses Evans of supporting vouchers and the governor's Opportunity School District. Evans accuses Abrams of compromising with Governor Nathan Deal on the Hope Scholarship. So they have equanimity, if you will, in mm-hmm. on the issues thing. What I thought was interesting, two people we've had here on the show, Melita Easters, mm-hmm. Put out something immediately mm-hmm. on Saturday afternoon that said, we've got these two women appearing at a forum on October 2nd, yeah. I believe at the Carter Center. And it's going to be a very polite dialogue, and everybody's going to listen to each other. And then you had Nan Orok, who took up in defense of Stacey Abrams, saying that Evans, this is democracy. This is if you go into a before a group of rowdy progressives, you're going to get booed if you're not holding the right position.
All right, so let's talk about that and set the stage a bit. Stacey Abrams was in South Georgia. I think was she in Savannah area?
Savannah.
Where the Georgia Legislative Black Caucus was meeting.
Right. So she was asked, did you ask her, talk to her directly, Greg?
I texted her, but I got a statement later.
Okay. And what she said about this was?
Was that I will not condemn peaceful protest. Was the sort of paraphrase of it. It was she would not rebuke. She was being called on by Representative Scott Holcomb and some others to chastise the protesters for not letting her opponent speak. And she said, "I won't do that. That there's a long and rich tradition of civil protests, and this was one of them." Now, other people have since come out saying this was there was nothing peaceful about it. I saw a scuffle afterwards. There was some shouting. There was a lot of people whose feelings were hurt. So I don't know if you know what the definition of peaceful is, but her stance was, "I'm not going to back down."
What do we think of that?
Well, I think what we're waiting for now is the other shoe to drop. If Evans is going to have a viable campaign, she's very quickly going to have some pretty big names among the African American political community step up and step out for.
But do we think that Stacey Abrams, perhaps, does she make her cause stronger by refusing to be critical, or would it have been better for her if she'd said, "I would never want to see anyone not have a chance to express themselves in
situation"?
In a sense,
she was these were her supporters. As much as some on social media tried to say they weren't doing this for Stacey Abrams, they were holding signs and chanting, "Support Black women, trust Black women." So in a sense, she couldn't have rebuked them because she would just have egg on her face. But also, I think she does believe that was peaceful protest, and it could happen to her too.
Look, you've got a generational thing going here. I think you have. I mean, we've had African Americans in Georgia politics in the state capitol since Grace Hamilton in the 60s, and you've got some very well respected African Americans in the state capitol now, who are looking at what's going on and just wondering where their party is headed. Because right now, even though the demographics are in the favor of minorities, if you have strict polarization by racial lines in politics, Democratic Party is a loser.
Well, let me share with you a tweet we got from Angela Ford, one of our listeners. She says, "I'm a Black woman, and I did not like the fact that Stacey Evans wasn't allowed to speak. We need to be better than this." And then she tweeted, "We must, in all caps, vote on issues, not all caps race. We will not heal as a country if we don't." You know, the last thing that the Georgia Democratic Party, or for that matter, the National Democratic Party, needs at a moment when they think Republicans are fractured is to play out this kind of fight on a big public scale.
Yeah. I mean, I tweeted right after the protest that I got a dozen, within a few minutes, I got a dozen texts from Republicans, some gleeful about what was happening. And by the end of the day, I probably doubled that. And the irony of all this, by the way, is that Stacey Abrams is not some progressive purist. Even though she was kind of getting rock star treatment, I mean, those of us in Georgia know that she at least early in her career as a minority leader was very much a pragmatist who worked with Republicans much more so than her counterparts in the Senate on deals just like the Hope Scholarship deal that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show the other day. That this you wrote about the Stacey Abrams. What did she call it?
The strike team.
The strike team. And we talked about it, that her bringing it up at this conference was interesting because, of course, that has been what some Democrats have said was wrong with Stacey Abrams as minority leader. She was so willing to compromise and reach across the aisle. So it's not a surprise, really, in a progressive group that she would highlight this strike force that apparently was trying to be obstructionist in terms of its dealing with the Republican majority in the House. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I will tell you what, it is the Schadenfreude that you're hearing from the Republican side. I mean they were just Republicans have felt so beat up in the era of Donald Trump, and to see this breakout on the opposite side saying that all is not love and candy over there, it gives them great encouragement. I think your chances of a Republican repeat in the governorship just went up a good bit.
Interesting. You agree with that, Greg?
It's going to be if this division lingers on the Democratic side, it's got to favor Republicans.
All right. Let me, as we run out of time here, share with you a couple of your tweets. We got a tweet from Douglas C. Taylor, who tweets at Douglas C. Taylor. Trumpism delenda est. My Latin is bad, so I'm not quite sure what that means. Says, I just listened from Savannah, a bit of a dodge on Trump, referring back to our visit with Senator Isaacson, a bit of a dodge on Trump, but still what he said about Senator John McCain should be boilerplate for everyone. I mentioned there were some tweets that were disappointed in the way Isaacson didn't directly confront some of President Trump's conduct. Bitter Pill says the senator may be considered courtly, in quotes. That was the New York Times characterization of him. But his dodging the question about Trump's character is snake-like. Angela Ford, who we heard from a minute ago, tweeted, I wish politicians would stop looking the other way or explaining 45's behavior. He does not represent the majority. He has no dignity. It's what a bind for these Republicans in the Senate and House to deal with this president of ours. All right, we are out of time for today's show. Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway, thanks for being here. It was great to have Johnny Isaacson in the studio.
That was fantastic.
And I apologize, I didn't realize you'd been covering him even longer than I have, because I'm so much older than you, Galloway. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, I was just a drone in the state capitol, just a 24, 25-year-old drone.
All right, we're going to be back on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, is going to be back with us. We've got her on a schedule. She likes being here, and you tell us in your tweets you like hearing her. So she'll be here, and she's going to be here with Patricia Murphy, the columnist for The Daily Beast, who we haven't had in for a while. And Greg Bluestein, I hope you're going to come back and be with us. It's Wednesday. We like having you here.
I'll be here.
Wednesday. Friday, Jim Galloway will be back with me, and we have a great lineup. Eric Tanenblatt, who we haven't seen in a while, is going to be in here. So is Beth Shapiro. And Michael Owens, the chair of the Cobb County Democratic Party. So that's the rest of the week on Political Rewind. I'll tell you more about Two-Way Street on Wednesday's show. Until then, thank you to Olivia, to Jenny, to Tyler for all your work on the show today. We'll see you again Wednesday at 2:00.